and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we talk about the U.S.-North Korean summit in Vietnam, which is starting this Wednesday. Then, the Oakland teacher strike continues into its third day. And finally, it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garafa. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. President Trump yesterday said that he will delay the planned increase in tariffs on Chinese goods. China and the United States have been in talks to negotiate an end to the trade war between the two countries. Tariffs were scheduled to rise this Friday from 10% to 25% on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. Britain's Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn said in a statement today concerning a second Brexit referendum, quote, "We are committed to putting forward or supporting an amendment in favor of a public vote to prevent a damaging Tory Brexit being forced on the country," unquote. U.S. officials said today that a U.S. airstrike in Somalia killed 35 al-Shabaab militants. Al-Shabaab is an affiliate of al-Qaeda. Airstrikes in Somalia have increased in the last few years, which analysts attribute to President Trump's easing of restrictions on when the U.S. military can strike alleged terrorists. A similar airstrike last month in Somalia killed 52 people. The Trump administration is setting up a panel of conservative scientists to dispute the existence of climate change, whether changes are from human behavior or not, and if society can make positive changes to mitigate the warming climate. Three senior administration officials say the goal of the group is to, quote, counter conclusions that the continued burning of fossil fuels is harming the planet, unquote. That's according to the Washington Post. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the summit with North Korea. Our own Brian Becker is in Hanoi this week to cover the second summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The president said yesterday that he has high hopes for the meetings this week and that he and Kim are, quote, on the same page, period. He also said that he's confident the two countries can settle many of their differences. Administration officials are suggesting that Vietnam could be a model for a future North Korea. Brian joins us from Hanoi. Brian, have you had much sleep?
No sleep. But it's very exciting here, I have to say, all across the city of Hanoi, the former capital of what was North Vietnam, now the capital of a unified Vietnam. All over the city, there are big posters announcing the summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. There's the American flag, the Vietnamese flag, and the North Korean flag almost at every intersection. So obviously the city is on short notice getting ready for what's for Hanoi a very big deal. They expect 3,000 journalists here. Just to tell you how ridiculous some of the media coverage is, I was looking at an AP report about the upcoming summit, and the first words were something like this. I'm paraphrasing. With North Korea leader Kim Jong-un on an armored train barreling through China towards the Vietnamese. It sounds like he must have had machine guns personally pointed out the window, shooting people and mowing them down as he barreled through China. Anyway, that's the kind of Western media. But here I'm looking at Vietnam News, which is an English language daily that's produced every day here in Hanoi. Obviously, the country is very excited about the prospects that Vietnam, which was, of course, a prime adversary of the United States, fought a long war with the United States, and later, after it defeated the United States, was able to come to a peace arrangement with the United States. I think Vietnam is well aware of the profound symbolism of being the host of a similar possibility here. Again, the Korean War was supposed to end in 1953. An armistice was signed on July 27th, 1953. That means that'll be 66 years this July. And what the North Koreans and the South Koreans are saying, and what apparently now Donald Trump might be saying, is that it's time to have that war end, just as the war in Vietnam finally did end in 1975.
Well, Brian, let me ask you about that, because the New York Times, just as one example, is actually worried about that. They're worried that Donald Trump is going to offer up an end to the Korean War, some sort of a peace treaty. and that would, these are the New York Times' words, that would legitimize Kim Jong-un. Another thing that they're afraid of, and I want to know if you're hearing this kind of thing, is that Trump may offer diplomatic representation both in Washington and Pyongyang, not at the embassy level, not full diplomatic relations, but an interest section. Are you hearing anything like that?
I mean, right now, the Trump administration in the run-up to this summit has been trying to give some sort of signal about what they think will come out of the summit. And I think it's important what they're saying. What they're telling the media off the record, behind the scenes, is that what they hope to accomplish here is giving definition to what it means to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. And then what's the mechanism that the two sides, North Korea and the United States, will establish for a step-by-step process for denuclearization. Now, that's a far different message than what you hear coming out of the mouths of John Bolton or earlier Mike Pompeo, Mike Pence, and others, including the New York Times, including the Democratic Party establishment, which is basically North Korea, as the beginning of the negotiations, must not only agree to disarm itself, but go through the process of fully disarming itself before there can be discussion of any other matter, like a peace treaty or like the lifting of sanctions. Now, one, that doesn't make any sense. How do you tell one side of a war that's still in process, you must disarm before we can start to talk to you about ending the war? When two sides are technically at war, neither side is going to disarm. And so the only conclusion one can draw from the demand on North Korea that it disarm in advance is that the people making that demand don't want this process to actually succeed. And it seems to me that Trump, and I think it's Trump himself, Mike Pompeo, of course, is his most loyal foreign policy aide, is echoing this. But Trump himself appears to have established a framework for these negotiations, which is actually compatible with the DPRK's understanding of what must be the framework for a successful negotiation, step by step, reciprocal, and a definition of what it means to denuclearize, because it doesn't mean simply North Korea giving up what might be 6 or 10 or 15 nuclear weapons. The United States has nuclear weapons on submarines. It has them on B-1 and B-2 bombers that routinely fly over North Korea or by North Korea and simulate the nuclear destruction of North Korea. And they have them in land-based missiles. So what North Korea wants is a guarantee from the United States that they don't really face an ongoing nuclear threat. So denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula means a comprehensive denuclearization. And I think the summit, if it's going to be meaningful, we'll have to go forward in trying to give definition to what that actually looks like.
Some of the highest ranking Democrats in the Senate, so this list includes Chuck Schumer, Dick Durbin, Dianne Feinstein, Sherrod Brown, Patrick Leahy, Bob Menendez, and Jack Reed, and Mark Warner. They all signed an open letter effectively expressing skepticism about the negotiations. And they sort of have a list of demands. You know, we hope you will, blah, blah, blah. And among those demands include, quote, continued appropriate sanctions and other pressure, and, quote, a robust deterrence posture. Basically, they're saying Trump is being too soft. I mean, how do you react to that? The Democratic Party, you know, their top leaders making this statement on the eve of the negotiations.
Well, you know, when Jimmy Carter first became president in 1977, he said the United States should start to withdraw troops from South Korea. And he was immediately attacked by the Pentagon, General James John Singlob, who was in charge of the U.S. military command in South Korea, and Democrats and Republicans alike. It seems to me to be that the consensus position in the Washington establishment for a long time has been that Korea should not be a place where peace can happen. And I think if you think back about it, the Korean War, starting in June 1950, also inaugurated the formation of what became known as the military-industrial complex. After World War II, the U.S. military demobilized. Then the Korean War happened, and the U.S. military remobilized, and it's never demobilized once again. And I think what's happened is that there's a powerful part of the U.S. political and economic establishment that knows full well that this a constant looming war threat or perceived war threat from somewhere, in this case, the Korean Peninsula, is actually a rationale, a justification for the continued looting of the national treasury to the tune of almost $1 trillion each and every year. So I think Schumer's comments and the other Democratic Party leaders' comments, it's not simply that if Trump said the sun rises in the east, they would say, no, it doesn't, because they oppose anything that Trump does, unless perhaps maybe dropping missiles on Syria. It's partly that, but it's even deeper than that. It's not simply a contest between Democrats and Republicans. It is the dominant position in the Washington foreign policy establishment. And you can't think of that establishment without thinking through that the military contractors and the banks who finance these operations, they play a central role in decision makers' policy orientation.
Big part of the narrative that sort of goes along with that consensus position that you're referring to is this idea that Donald Trump has given up too much to Kim Jong-un, that he's sort of given everything away without getting anything in return, you know, like John was saying, legitimizing Kim Jong-un. But that's really not true, right? I mean, what are some of the confidence-building measures that the DPRK has taken so far leading up to this summit and the previous summit as well?
Well, you know, the whole notion that Trump has given up so much is really kind of nonsense. I mean, in all ways, think back to what President Obama, what his position was. He said, we will have strategic patience towards North Korea, meaning no discussions, no negotiations. When North Korea agreed to stop missile tests and declare its own moratorium on nuclear tests, in return for stopping or a moratorium on American military exercises that simulate the destruction of North Korea, Obama said no. And so North Korea kept doing those things that America's policymakers say is so threatening. So Donald Trump took a different tack. He said, yeah, let's start negotiating. Let's start to have this summit process. And what did North Korea do? They stopped nuclear tests. They stopped intercontinental ballistic missile tests. They destroyed the Yongbyon nuclear reactor site. They released the remains of American missing in action from the Korean War and three Americans who were still detained in North Korean prisons. So if you want to talk about just objectively who got what in the negotiating process, obviously Obama got nothing. North Korea developed a nuclear arsenal that's fairly capable. President Trump took a different tact. And from a palpable point of view, North Korea has made unilateral concessions, but they won't be endless. What North Korea is now saying to the Trump administration is, look, we took these first steps. They're real. They're palpable. They're meaningful. But now we want to see what you're going to do. And that's why I want to go back to the issue of definition. What the North Koreans are talking about is they want to have a definition of denuclearization that's something other than just them disarming. What they want is a new regime, meaning a new system on the Korean Peninsula that is a peace system rather than a war system. What does that mean? That means to normalize relations between the United States and North Korea, exchange embassies, exchange ambassadors, treat each other as the United States or North Korea has relations with other countries. That's the first step. And the definition then will also be, if North Korea gets rid of some or all of its nuclear weapons, what will the United States do in terms of equivalency, or if it's not an exact equivalency, in the direction of equivalency or sort of a reciprocation that the North Koreans will say, guess what? That gives us a meaningful security guarantee. That's what is, in fact, the essence of this. So all the hot air in the Democrats denouncing Trump for giving up too much, it's obviously just factually on its face not true.
Brian, in our last minute and a half, I want you to comment on opposition to this summit. The top story on CNN this morning is Trump-Kim summit, what North Korean defectors think will happen. And yesterday's Washington Post had a front page article saying that Kim recently executed an opponent using a flamethrower. Of course, this is from a defector. There's absolutely no way to prove such an allegation. But we're seeing these things again during this summit, just like we saw it during the Singapore summit. Are you seeing any opposition activity in Hanoi right now?
No. I mean, the city is decked out. By the way, I just want to say one quick thing. The city's decked out with anticipation about the summit. This city is buzzing. It's a city of 7 million people. Everybody talks about Ho Chi Minh being a place where there's a lot of buzz. Well, this has a lot of buzz. I mean, you have to be here to really get a sense of it. It's 7 million people. It's largely a young population. You know what? People who live in Vietnam or in Korea or China or Russia or guess what? Almost anywhere else in the world other than the United States, when they hear these kind of propaganda pieces, I don't think they give it much weight. Every couple of weeks, some new story comes out about some new atrocity committed by Kim Jong-un. Almost all of the stories turn out later to be not true. The defectors are not credible. They're usually set up by the CIA or the South Korean CIA, and there's no accountability. I mean, remember Kim Jong-un had his ex-girlfriend executed with an anti-aircraft weapon because his wife was jealous, and then that was the headline, and then 3 months later, she was like performing, which is really a miracle to be blown up with an anti-aircraft weapon and be able to perform at a concert. But, you know, of course, we don't hear about her performing at the concert because the headlines that are fake news, not to use, well, let's use it. It is fake news. It's generated by intelligence agencies to torpedo the summit. The news headlines come, they leave a lasting impression. The correction maybe is made later. But the damage is done, and that's the whole point of it. You can always demonize your enemy, but the fact of the matter is the U.S. was at war with Germany and Japan in World War II. They signed an agreement to end the war, and right now those countries are allies. The United States fought a war with Vietnam. Millions of Vietnamese died. 58,000 Americans died. The war came to an end. An agreement was signed. The U.S. and Vietnam have good relations. The United States has good relations with the People's Republic of China. There's no reason why the United States can't have an end to the war with Korea and to have decent relations with North Korea. All the other headlines that people are hearing, and I want to say this for our audience, all of this propaganda is designed to have people come to the idea that peace is a bad idea in the Korean Peninsula. The fact of the matter is, and this is the truth, if Trump pulls this off, if he comes to a peace deal with North Korea, even though the elites may denounce him for it, it's going to be very popular. And I think he'll use it in the 2020 election campaign because the American people don't want more war. They want to give peace a chance. And to the extent that someone, even if it's Donald Trump, does it, people are going to listen to that with receptive ears.
We will leave it there. We will continue to have Brian join us from Hanoi this week while the summit is ongoing. We were happy to have him. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill normally helps us look at the state of education across the country, what's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us. But today we're joined from Oakland by Rick Ayers. He's a professor of education at the University of San Francisco. He's the author of An Empty Seat in Class, Teaching and Learning After the Death of a Student, and also co-author of the book You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. Welcome back, Rick.
Good morning.
Rick, you're in Oakland, and the Oakland teachers are on strike. It's my understanding that talks broke down over the weekend, and this strike could be a long one. What are you hearing?
It is going to be a difficult and long strike. This is after the series of strikes in the non-union or right-to-work states like West Virginia and Oklahoma. Now strikes have come to places like Los Angeles and Denver and now Oakland. And so this is a really big struggle between a very strong union with what's most important, tremendous community support, and a board which is pretty bad. Pretty problematic. We recently had board elections, and you know, one of the issues that's tearing it apart is this question of charters, and charters being a sort of lead to the strategy of privatization. So a lot of charter money went into this board election, and a number of these, most of the board members, pretty much are beholden to the charter campaign. So this is why it's not going to be easy. It's not just money. It's about the question of the kind of education we have, the kind of options young people have, and privatization. So I don't think either side is close to budging.
And so what practically does the strike mean? I mean, have there been major demonstrations? How have the pickets been going? What's the scene like, at the workplaces that are on strike?
Well, on the ground, it's a very exciting, a very strong mobilization. Every school is surrounded by pickets, and these are a lot of schools in Oakland, as you can imagine. And every day there's a big rally downtown at noon. So people will pickets in the morning. In fact, after I leave here, I'll be going back to the line. And then there's a noon rally, and then they go back to their sites. So, but not only that, we have, for instance, the Grand Lake Theater, which is kind of a progressive independent movie theater, was showing movies like Black Panther for $1 to allow young people to do something besides go to the school site. The bosses want students to go to the school site so they can count them for their daily attendance, even though they just have them sitting in the cafeteria. But there are many community spaces where young people are gathering and can go. So you saw all kinds of outpouring of people bringing food down, community demonstrations, youth demonstrations, supporting the strike. So that's crucial because it means it's a strike for education as a whole. And while living wage is an important part of the strike, it's not the only demand.
We're speaking from Oakland, California with Rick Ayers. He's a professor of education at the University of San Francisco and the author of several different books. Rick, there's something that I don't understand about the California education system. I hope you can enlighten me. There is a state fiscal oversight board, a state oversight trustee, who has ultimate authority over the school district's financial decisions. This one, a guy named Chris Learned, said in a written statement over the weekend that he would rescind any agreement granting the union's proposed 12% raise over 3 years. 12% raise over 3 years barely keeps up with inflation. And the state of California is running a budget surplus this year. Why would this be an unacceptable pay raise?
Well, I think, again, it's a confrontation of power, and these state oversight czars, which has happened in many states, is a complete undermining of democracy and the idea that there's local control of education. Right now, today, a whole caravan of teachers has gone up to Sacramento to demonstrate there because, as often happens, a local board says, well, we have nothing. We got nothing in the bank. But the state has tons of money. California is the fifth largest economy in the world. And yet California teachers are paid, I think the ADA is about 45th out of 50 states. So California has the money to make education, powerful in this state, but they're just not. So yes, there is a struggle with Sacramento, but there are other forces in Sacramento, such as this Democratic Party majority, which has to be pressured, who are stronger than this fiscal oversight czar, and they can override him. So there are a lot of very powerful forces on the side of the board and the repression of the teacher strike. Because for them, the reason they need to win is because this is the tipping point between whether we're going to have a majority of public schools or whether we're going to move to a patchwork of privately run corporate schools. And that's the direction of education. That's what's happened already in New Orleans. So they don't want to back down. They just feel like, well, this is the growing pains. This is what we have to do to beat these teachers down. And then we'll be in a whole new world of charters. And so what it's going to take as far as unity, the ability to hold out from the base of teachers and community people is quite a bit. Now, we also have national and international support pouring in. We have a lot of statements of solidarity. But as you know, as the strike drags on, it is a real test of a community's resilience. So that's what's at stake here.
Of course, education doesn't happen in a vacuum. What goes on in students and teachers' communities and the government, with the police, for instance, all of this has, a profound effect on the quality of education. Talk a little bit about the conditions in Oakland, if you would. How does, Oakland, for instance, is getting much, much more expensive to live in. How do all these different factors overlap?
Well, all of these go into it. But, the reality is, as you know, schools and education is one of the only institutions in our society where we are constantly in a debate about what kind of world we want to live in. It's a contested space. And part of the struggle here is just for holding a public space. Oakland is a difficult, and San Francisco is going to follow, difficult place to survive as a teacher. Teachers may get $45,000, $55,000 in pay, really not adequate. People can't survive on that. So this is one of the problems people have here. Also, you have to understand, you go to an Oakland school, it is really in bad shape. There'll be holes in the wall. There'll be no physics lab. There'll be, just really bad conditions. And you can walk 6 miles to a Piedmont school, Piedmont being a small suburb right next to Oakland. And that high school, Piedmont High School, has state-of-the-art labs, state-of-the-art facilities up and down the line, and a beautiful sports field. So how can we live in a society where within 6 miles is this big of a gap? It is actually kind of a failure of the civil rights struggle for education equity. We all teach our kids about Brown versus Board and what a great success it was, but actually it's the same situation, if not worse. That struggle continues.
Rick, I'm looking at an NBC San Francisco video that says the basic teacher demands are demands that we hear all the time. Smaller class sizes, more support staff, a pay raise. We saw the same demands in Los Angeles. We see them all over the place. Is this something that we're going to see more of in California, and not just in these very large districts like Los Angeles and Oakland? Is this just the beginning of a wave of teacher strikes, the kind of strikes that we saw in the red states late last year?
Yes, I think it is. And I actually think, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but there's certainly the possibility of a statewide strike. That's the way you really hit Sacramento. And the reason this is such a big deal is because education and the future of education is being fought out right here and now. And it's come to a point where either the privatization people will win and totally take over the schools, or we will begin to take back the public space. The only formation that has the ability to lead this kind of struggle is the teachers' unions. I mean, it can be a community struggle. It can be a student struggle. It can be all kinds of different interest groups, but the teachers' unions is the only organized force to pull this together.
Well, that was the voice of Rick Ayers, who joined us from Oakland, California. He's a professor of education at the University of San Francisco. He's the author of An Empty Seat in Class, Teaching and Learning After the Death of a Student. And he's also co-author of the book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers' Unions, and Public Education. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We are joined in studio by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, good morning. Great to be here with you.
So there's a really disturbing story about social media surveillance of Chicago public school students. Let's start there. What's going on with that situation?
Yeah, so this is a story that was just put out a week or so ago on WBEZ. This is talking about in Chicago public schools, they actually have social media analysts who are monitoring the social media profiles of students and turning them over to police if they are suspected of being gang members. This program has been going on for a number of years. And this is actually something supported by the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice funds programs like this across the country. So in this story, it explains that there was no imminent threat of violence against the school or any individual, anyone else. But a school district security officer actually had a meeting with a student and asked him, based on social media posts that the school officer had seen, whether or not he was trying to join a gang or was involved with gangs, or if he knew the names of anyone else in a gang. And this, to me, this is just such an overreach of what a school system should be doing. We're talking about school systems that we see teachers going on strike everywhere for resources, right? Well, what could we do with the millions of dollars spent on this program in schools rather than spying on students' social media? It's such a privacy overreach.
And imagine the manpower that's necessary to spy on students like this. I mean, there have to be tens of thousands of students that might pop up on the radar of a so-called school resources officer, a uniformed armed cop whose job it is to stand in the lobby of the school and intimidate people. But imagine the cost to the taxpayer and what little return there is.
That's right. There is a very little proof that this actually covers, that this actually solves anything, mm-hmm. right? And yeah, so and it's the militarization of our schools effectively, but not just the physical schools, not just metal detectors in the lobbies and, you know, so-called resource officers, which are really cops or other security guards. This is now monitoring their social media. Now, this could be done in a sense to, you know, to help students. You know, if students are being bullied, if students are, you know, having a hard time, a guidance counselor, a social worker, you know, could try to approach them and talk to them. But no, this is being used for so-called gang intervention. But there's no proof, you know, of anything. This student said he was not in a gang. He knew gang members, but he refused to provide the names of the gang members. You know, he refused to rat out people, you know, his friends or people in his community. And they said that he, quote, seemed to not be motivated and provide very short answers.
Right. Don't young people also have the protection from unreasonable search and seizure? I mean, just because you're a minor doesn't mean that you forfeit all rights. You know, Chicago Public Schools, that's overwhelmingly working class Black and Latino students. And everybody appears to be under suspicion by the police and by this new surveillance unit that's been created at great expense to taxpayers. Everybody's suspected, right, of being a criminal of some sort or the other. And their private information, their private social media profiles are being searched.
That's right. So students do have protections. They have First Amendment protections. They have other protections. In some cases, you know, schools may give access to your locker because it's school property, but particularly when it comes to this kind of just overreach, we've also seen it. There was a school district in Virginia a few years ago that gave every student a laptop with a camera, and it turned out that that camera was on at some times when the students were home, and it captured images of underage students. These students were almost all under 18. It captured images of them doing their homework, in some cases getting dressed, and so many other things. And the school district had to apologize and I believe paid out a significant sum of money for this. Of course, the school district said this was an accident. No one was being monitored. But that's what they always say, right?
So what's the logical conclusion of this? I mean, is this going to become standard practice in school districts all across the country?
That's where it seems like it's going. And students and teachers have been speaking out against it in Chicago and all over the country. People have been saying that this is not an appropriate use of resources. If they have hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to spend on surveillance, then they have that same amount of money to spend on teachers. They have that same amount of money to spend on classrooms and failing infrastructure and books and food for students and all of the things that our schools actually need.
There's a related story. I'm looking at a headline here. How did the police know you were near a crime scene? Google told them. Another example of law enforcement and surveillance technology sort of merging here.
That's right. So we know Google and Apple track us everywhere we go. On top of that, our cell phone companies also track us everywhere we go. And it's very, very easy for a prosecutor to get a subpoena from any of those companies to figure out where you were. So if you use, you know, I used a maps program to get here this morning to the studio. I don't know DC very well. And, you know, if there was a subpoena, they could say, hey, you know what, Chris was at the studio this morning, and figure out, you know, exactly where I was. It's not just that, right? It's pinging every so often. It's pinging back to a cell tower. It's pinging back to Apple and Google's servers, too, in order to tell them where you are. And they will reply, you know, and comply with subpoenas. Now, different companies will fight a little bit harder or a little, you know, or give in easier. In this case, it says that Google fought the subpoena at first, but then eventually complied. Some companies will just comply and hand over the information without even, you know, giving it a second thought.
I think one of the reasons why most companies comply is most big information or IT companies have relationships with federal agencies, whether it's the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, DOD, especially DARPA. They work together. And so why would they fight their sponsoring agency on one hand and then take their sponsoring agency's money on the other hand? It doesn't make any sense. My guess is that more and more companies are going to just not even try to put up a fight, legal or otherwise, with these governmental agencies. They're just going to give in.
That's right. Ultimately, they do give in. If we remember a couple of years ago, Apple had a public little spat with the FBI over getting into this iPhone from the San Bernardino shootings. You know, ultimately, the FBI actually partnered with an Israeli intelligence firm in order to do that. That was not because of privacy. That was because Apple wanted to protect its trade secrets. Ultimately, they wanted to protect how they encrypt things on your iPhone, which is, for Apple, a selling point. But Apple is also named in this story as one of those companies that will hand over your location data with a subpoena.
I want to read a paragraph from this article that we're talking about. This is from nprnews.org. So this is talking about how Google Maps is used by police agencies. A reverse location search warrant differs from a traditional search warrant in that it doesn't identify a suspect and establish probable cause to ask for evidence of a suspect's crime. Instead, it asks for information about everyone in an area at a certain time, working backwards to identify a suspect. I mean, that's shocking. Like, that's just the complete abrogation of people's constitutional rights.
Yeah, and this is not uncommon. These kind of warrants happen frequently, but also police departments themselves have what's called a stingray device, which can identify what cell phones are in a certain area. They do that for crowd control sometimes at concerts, particularly, though, they do it at protests. If you're at a political event, the police will deploy a stingray, and they will be able to see the, you know, certain identifying information about the cell phone. And all they have to do is ask the cell phone company, hey, whose phone is this? And then they know who it is. Even if they don't know who it is, they can make associations. So if your phone and somebody else's phone go down the same streets at the same time, they can make an association. If they figure out one, then they can pressure you to figure out both. So, and that's, to me, that is extra legal, the use of the stingrays. Whereas these warrants that they get, these reverse location warrants, also should be illegal, right? These are such a wide net. They are catching so many people in this, and it should be absolutely illegal to do this. And it needs to be challenged at higher levels of the courts.
Yeah, the stingray, I remember the stingray was in, I don't know if it was the Supreme Court or an appellate court, but I mean, there are active legal challenges underway to these, correct?
Yes, there are active legal challenges. There has been no final decision yet. And so police departments are still using them, not just police departments, you know, locally and in cities around the country, but the federal government uses them as well.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with technologist and web developer Chris Garaffa. Chris, let's go to our next story for today's segment. There's some new information that we learned about Google Nest.
This is absolutely terrifying. People who have a Nest, it's a home device, a smart home device. They were never advertised as having a microphone in them, but it turns out somebody cracked one open and sitting right there was a microphone. The company says that they never used the microphone. It was not enabled yet, but now Google is promoting it as a feature. they're saying that this is now going to be a feature that they can turn on. It can be a Google Assistant where you can just like, you know, an Amazon's the cylinders or a HomePod with Siri or whatnot. You can speak to it and get Google to, you know, do searches or tell you the weather or give you the news or whatnot. It is outrageous to me, though, that this microphone was in there and no one knew until somebody took one of these apart and said, hey, what is this little bit in here? And analyzed it. And it turned out to be a microphone full with recording and audio analysis chipsets that you would need to have, you know, a microphone and integrated device. It probably cost them nothing. They probably were thinking in the future that they would be, you know, enable something like this. It, you know, cost very little to have that part put in bulk. But that should at the very least have been advertised. There is a microphone in this device. We don't even know what we're putting in our homes at this point, right? Anyone who has a Nest, you need to know that your Nest Secure has a microphone in it. And you need to decide for yourself whether or not you trust Google as to whether it's been recording you or not, or when it's going to start. If the software updates itself, then it could start recording you and you might miss the email saying, hey, new great features on your Nest. So I'm going to leave it up to the listeners to determine whether or not they're going to trust Google with this or whether they're going to take their Nest, unplug it, and toss it out in the trash.
This was never revealed in, you know, the bottom of the 25th page of the user manual or in some obscure announcement. This was a secret on behalf of Google, of Nest, was it not, or Google?
Yeah, this was an absolute secret. They had no documentation of it anywhere. There was nothing. Again, somebody cracked their Nest Secure device open and looked at it and said, hey, that's a microphone.
What value is the information that one of these microphones could pick up to Google? I mean, how do you monetize eavesdropping on people going about their day-to-day lives?
Well, Google says that they just listen when you say the watchword. So that's the, you know, hey Siri or hey Google or whatever the command is for your device, right? But the thing is, they have to be listening all the time in order to pick up that word. Now, these companies, all of them, Amazon, Apple, Google, they say that, yes, they listen, they save a few seconds of audio, and then they throw it away if you haven't said that specific word. Except we've seen cases where either intentionally or accidentally, somebody's Amazon device, for example, has been triggered into recording, and then, you know, that audio is sent to Amazon. And they're sent to Amazon, not just, you know, Amazon corporate, but subcontractors, where there's very little, if any, oversight about where this audio is stored, who's listening to it, all of that kind of stuff. And people have actually gotten back, you know, from Amazon, the wrong recordings, because you can request the recordings that you've made. People have submitted their request to Amazon and gotten back somebody else's recordings. So they're doing a number of things with this. First of all, they're looking at what you're asking about. Are you asking about sports games? Are you trying to get sports scores? Well, then they know that, you know, for example, I'm a fan of the Boston Red Sox, and then they're going to advertise Red Sox stuff to me, right? They could, you know, you could be asking about weather in a different location. And so they know that you might be wanting to travel or you have some sort of connection to that location. That's really, you know, the information that they're trying to get from you is you're, you know, by asking it questions, just like you would when you Google, you know, something. When you Google search something, you're letting Google build a profile for you or of you in order to learn how to, you know, what you're interested in so it can show you more relevant advertisements.
I have a question, too, about that. As a joke with my kids the other day, I said, hey, Alexa, where can I bury a body? And rather than responding to me, it just beeped. Did it report me to the cops?
John, I don't know if you could be on more lists, but you might be now.
I was just curious. My kids didn't think it was funny.
So, I mean, like, imagine if you're in a political meeting, if you're trying to plan a rally or a demonstration or something like that. You know, it's not uncommon for that to happen in people's private homes. Could that potentially be used for surveillance activities of protected First Amendment activities?
It absolutely could be. There is no question that this could be. Whether it has or not, I imagine it has, but we haven't seen any explicit evidence. Usually in cases like this where law enforcement has a way to, you know, get into a device like this, they will do what's called parallel construction. They will use the evidence that they've gotten illegally to try to create a legal case using that, you know, using not that evidence, but using the conclusions that it's brought, that evidence has brought to them, and go backwards and try to recreate the case with legal evidence that they now know to look for.
Let's go on to another story. This is I mean, it's kind of fun, but it's also really disturbing. So this is from Wired. The headline is, "I tried to keep my unborn child's secret from Facebook and Google, and the author of this failed to do that." What's that story all about? I mean, how was the internet, I guess, if you want to say it that way, the internet writ large, able to find out like very intimate details about this person's life?
Yeah, so this author, James Temperton, wanted to keep his child a secret, basically, from the internet. And so we're saying from Google, from Facebook, from Amazon, from all of the advertising companies that we don't even know of. And he failed. So they didn't purchase stuff online for the baby. They didn't post about the baby on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or anywhere. They tried to, you know, do as few searches as possible online about, you know, what, the, you know, things that infant, you know, health and things like that, right? And still, they turned out to get advertisements for baby things. Now, this is, you know, James and his partner, they put a lot of work into this. They put a really significant amount of work into this, and they had to be very cautious about, you know, not only what they were talking about when they had their phones around, because we know that our phones do listen, but what they searched for, what they bought. Again, so they would actually buy, in some cases, prepaid debit cards and use those on Amazon. If they had to buy something on Amazon that they couldn't purchase elsewhere with cash, if they purchased something physically, they used cash to buy it. So there was no credit card transaction. The point here, I think, is that, you know, and this is not to, you know, say they were wrong, but they probably at some point made a mistake. They probably searched for something while logged into Google on some device that they have, or they, you know, said something in a private message in a conversation somewhere on Facebook or Instagram or wherever, even though they say they asked people not to. They said, delete this message. Well, once the message is sent, if a family member sends you, hey, send me pictures of the baby, or how's the baby, or how's the pregnancy going, that's already there. Facebook knows through Messenger that that's something that you have. You're having a baby. That's something that's going on in your life, and it can use that to target you. This story really just shows that, as they start out the story, the internet hates secrets, and it is very, very difficult to keep anything hidden from the internet.
That's shocking.
It's terrible, actually. It's terrible.
I don't even know what more to say about that.
We should say, you know, there was a story a number of years ago about a teenage girl who had gotten pregnant, and based on the things she was buying at Target, Target started sending her maternity coupons for maternity items to her home. And her father checked the mail and was very, very upset as to why Target was sending maternity items or coupons for maternity items to his 15 or 16 year old daughter. And then she had to explain to him why. And, you know, it turned out to be, you know, very outrageous. And the Target, they can actually tell when you're just buying something, you know, certain medication, creams for aches or anything like that. They can say, OK, well, people who buy this end up buying diapers a few months later. Therefore, you might be pregnant.
So has privacy been like de facto abolished by big corporations like Google and Facebook, big data, the internet companies?
It's been all but abolished. Their goal is to abolish privacy. I will never say that they have succeeded in that. We can take so many steps. Of course, you have to put a lot of work into it, as James Temperton and his wife did. You have to put a lot of work into it, but it will never be abolished so long as there is a movement for privacy. And that's what we need to be building and sustaining. We need to build a movement for privacy to defend our rights to privacy, especially against government overreach and these major corporations that are accountable to no one but their shareholders.
Yeah, very important point. And of course, that has to be a collective struggle, right? I mean, the people who own Facebook and Google and, you know, any of these other corporations that we're talking about, Apple, they're a very, very small group of people. They just happen to be incredibly, incredibly wealthy and well-resourced. But, you know, of course, there's many, 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 many millions of times more people who are completely outraged by these practices. But as we build that movement, of course, there are sort of individual actions that people can take to mitigate some of these effects. So like, for instance, I'm wondering if the couple that, you know, is referenced in this article, the author, James Temperton's family, if they say used Tor or another, you know, sort of encrypted browsing device, and Google searches or any type of searches about baby supply. I mean, would that have worked? Like, what could they have done differently?
Sure. They, if you use Tor, then Google is not building a profile on you. You know, Tor just, it anonymizes your traffic. It sends your internet traffic through a bunch of different computers all around the internet. And those computers only know the step after them and the step before them. They don't know where you are, and they don't know the final source of your traffic, right? So as long as you're not logging into your Gmail account while using Tor, then you're good. You don't have to worry about, you know, about that tracking for the most part. You don't want to be logging into your Facebook or Google account, because then you still can be tracked because you've basically told them who you are.
Mm-hmm. And what email accounts should people use?
You know, I use a service called ProtonMail. It has a free tier. It is one of the most secure email services out there. And especially if you're sending mail to another ProtonMail user, you can. They have high privacy guarantees and say that even if they get subpoenaed, they won't have anything to hand over.
Is there anything you can do about the microphones in your phone? I mean, if James Temperton, the author of this article, and his partner, I mean, if they even just have a conversation in the vicinity of their phone, does that kind of give it away? Is there anything you can do about just sort of the constant eavesdropping of having a cell phone on you?
Especially since you can't take the battery out anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You can't take the battery out. So when the group FaceTime bug from a few weeks ago came out, I spent a lot of time trying to see if there was a way to disable the microphone in an iPhone. So this was the bug where in the FaceTime video chat feature on iPhones, where if you the caller could force your phone to turn the microphone or even camera on without you knowing it. Apple has since fixed this bug, which is great, but I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, is there a way to turn off the microphone in the iPhone? And it turns out there is not. Actually, iPhones have multiple microphones in them, not just the one at the bottom, but there are some all around the device. And there is no way that I could find to trick an iPhone into turning the microphone off. I tried, you know, plugging in headphones with that don't have a microphone on them, hoping that that would, you know, trick it. I tried cutting the cable, actually, on headphones that do have a microphone on them, because if you plug in headphones that have a microphone, it's going to use that one primarily. That didn't work either. I blew a lot of money cutting up my headphones trying to figure this out for people. But unfortunately, there is no way to do it. You know, going back to, Walter, what you said earlier, you know, if people are having political meetings and trying to plan something, the best thing you can do really is shut your phone off and put it in another room, shut the door, you know, maybe turn on some noise next to the phones and put them under everyone's coats, really, as a way to protect yourself.
Friends of mine, when they have meetings of, you know, political meetings, activist meetings, they put all their phones in a microwave and just keep it in there until the meeting's over, just because it's the safest place to put it.
Just don't turn it on.
Don't turn it on.
Don't turn it on.
Yeah. Let me ask you real quickly, why are there multiple microphones on an iPhone?
You know, it actually isn't that bad of an idea to have multiple microphones on a speakerphone system. You know, you want to have the best audio quality, right? So if you're on speakerphone and you want people to be able to hear you, whether or not your phone is pointed at you or away from you, you know, they do some very smart sound balancing in order to get the figure out where you are in terms of, you know, your vicinity of to the phone and to be able to hear you and to funnel, you know, your voice over that call rather than some background noise. So really advanced sound engineering technology, which is great, just could be used for the wrong purpose.
There is some backlash to all of this that we're talking about. A number of fitness apps, you know, quite popular fitness apps, decided that they would stop sharing the information that they get from the people who are using their product with Facebook. Tell us a little bit more about the details of that situation.
Sure. This is a really fast-moving story. It started out with an investigation from the Wall Street Journal on Thursday that said that there were a number of fitness and, you know, health, personal health applications that were sending information, very detailed information about people's weight and exercise and all these other things back to Facebook, especially, and it could be identified personally if you were logged into Facebook in the app. You know, you get these. You open an app and it says log in through Facebook. And that means great. You don't have to remember another password. You don't have to do anything. It just logs in with your identity and you can share things with friends. But that means that that app is now tied to your Facebook account, and Facebook can get information from that app about basically anything that app stores about you. Facebook provides packages for app developers to put into their applications to do analytics, right? To see how many people are using the app, to see what parts of the app people are using, and things like that. What happened here is that I think the most famous example is going to be the app Lose It, where you can track your exercise and the calories you burn and the food that you eat, so you can see how many calories in and calories out you have per day. That was sending your weight every day or every time you logged it to Facebook. There was another, number of other apps, one called Flow Health that was tracking people's menstrual cycles. And that was sending when a person's period started and ended back to Facebook. Why does Facebook need that?
It's chilling.
Workers at these corporations can make a big difference, too, when it comes to fighting back against massive surveillance. In Microsoft, the Microsoft workers are opposing a contract or a potential contract with the military that would turn warfare, this is from a headline in the Washington Post, turn warfare into a video game. What's that all about?
You know, Microsoft officials have already defended their contracts with the Army, with the Department of Defense, with the entire Pentagon establishment recently, saying that they want the U.S. armed forces to have the best of the best in terms of technology. What this is deadly technology, right? So this is called the HoloLens. It's kind of a heads-up display. It puts all this information in front of you. Like you see in the futuristic sci-fi movies, right? The heads-up display, it's got information about a person or how far something is, like on your glasses, right? But this is becoming real, and Microsoft is working on this in partnership with the military. So on Friday, a number of Microsoft employees sent a letter to the leadership saying, I'm going to quote, "As employees and shareholders, we do not want to become war profiteers. To that end, we believe that Microsoft must stop in its activities to empower the U.S. Army's ability to cause harm and violence." So that's from the statement that the Microsoft employees and some shareholders actually sent to the company. This is following, of course, in the heels of Amazon employees protesting the recognition facial technology that it is selling to the government, of Google employees protesting Project Maven, which was, another Pentagon partnership. And I wish, the best. People should be supporting these Microsoft employees and standing with them, and also putting pressure on Microsoft themselves to say that they do not want this technology from Microsoft in the hands of the U.S. Army to increase the U.S. Army's lethality.
We're getting towards the end of our segment. What's our tech tip for this week?
So the tech tip of this week is something that came up in the last few days with my work. You want to be aware of how much information you're putting out about yourself. You don't want to be doxxed. Now, doxxed means that somebody puts out who you are, your address, your phone number, your family's information, things like that, that might be publicly or semi-publicly available. Even if you're commenting anonymously or pseudonymously on the internet, let's say on Reddit with a screen name that isn't tied to you, if you're saying that, in other comments completely unrelated to the story, that you travel, for example, from, one part of Chicago to another every day, and you have a son and you got married at this time, it can actually be very easy to track down who you are. I had to deal with the situation with a volunteer from my workplace recently and said, hey, it could be very easy to track this person and figure out, exactly who they are. We appreciated that they were defending us online. But the fact is that these internet trolls will spend, so much time and resources trying to attack people and possibly harm people. So even if you think that the information you're putting out there isn't personally identifiable, for people who have so much time and resources to try to harm others, be aware that it could actually end up doing damage to you.
Okay, we'll leave it there. We were joined here in the studio by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking that page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
La 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 la